You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up today at 6 on 1A+, low pay, burnout, and stress are just some of the reasons behind a massive nationwide teacher shortage. An estimated 300,000 public school teachers and staff have left the profession since the start of the pandemic. That's forced those in charge of schools to get creative. Find out more today at 6 on 1A+. Now, making new friends can be really hard, especially as a grown-up. And keeping up those existing friendships as life changes can be a big challenge, too. Our next guest says the science of attachment can teach us a lot about our own strengths and weaknesses as friends and what we look for in friendships. And she's got advice to make it easier to find new friends and to be a good friend to the ones you've got. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Is there a friendship in your life that's really been important to you? What works for maintaining close friendships in your own life? Have you found ways to make new friends, or is it a challenge for you like it is for a lot of people? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Marissa G. Franco is an assistant clinical professor of university honors at the University of Maryland. She's the author of the new book, Platonic: How the Science of Attachment Can Help You Make and Keep Friends. Marissa, thanks a lot for joining us.
Me.
Now, you opened the book with a personal moment for you. A romantic relationship ended. And tell us how important your friends were in rising up from that moment.
Yeah, so to heal from that at the time, I decided to start this wellness group with my friends where we would meditate, cook, do yoga together. And I just really felt the love from all of them. And it led me to question some ideas that I had about love, that romantic love was the only love that counted, the only love that made me worthy, that, you know, proved my value. And so I started to wonder, why doesn't platonic love matter? Like, why hasn't it mattered to me that I'm loved by all of these people? Why have I treated it like this is secondary and illegitimate and romantic love is the only legitimate form of connection? So I sort of went on a quest to level this hierarchy of love that I think hurts people who are within and outside of romantic relationships because it makes us really devalue friendship. And so that's part of the reason that I decided to write Platonic.
I think we all might know, yeah, having friends, that's a good thing. Nothing wrong with that. You really lay out how important friends can be and having those connections. What are some of the benefits of having good friendships?
Yeah. So loneliness is as toxic for our bodies as smoking 15 cigarettes a day. And you might think, okay, but I can cure my loneliness through my spouse or my family, right? But there's actually three types of loneliness, only one in which can be met through a spouse, which is intimate loneliness, the desire for someone to have a very close connection with, like you have with a spouse or a best friend. But there's also relational loneliness. We have a desire for people that are about as close to us as a friend. And then collective loneliness, which is the desire for being part of a group that's working towards a common goal. And any of these forms of loneliness can be at play, such that even if we're very happy with our spouse, we can still end up feeling lonely because basically this suggests that we've always needed an entire community to feel truly whole.
And you share some of the numbers there. We Americans are kind of bad at this. Our numbers of friends, our friend networks are going down from year to year. What do you think is driving that?
Oh, man, so many different factors. You know, it really started with the creation of the television in the 1950s. And before then, leisure was a public affair that people did with their friends when they had free time. They just spent it with other people. But then people just started to spend their free time in front of the television. And in 2012, we also see spikes in loneliness. And that's around the time when the smartphone really became popular. And of course, there's ways to use technology to foster connection. But what it does is it has opportunity costs, right? That if we're using this technology every day for entertainment, to pass the time, we're not hanging out, which is what we would do if we were maybe more bored and didn't have this low-hanging fruit that gives us almost a snack of connection, parasocial connections. We feel connected to people we don't even know. And the snack makes us not realize just how hungry we are for the full meal of connection, the in-person interaction.
We're talking to Marissa G. Franco about her new book. It's called Platonic: How the Science of Attachment Can Help You Make and Keep Friends. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Has friendship been an important thing in your life? Do you have a friend you want to talk about with us? Or has it been a challenge for you, maybe as you age? Spend more time with your family. Is it harder to make and keep friendships, or have you moved someplace new? What worked? What didn't work with making new friends? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Marissa, let's get to work. In that situation, somebody's thinking, yeah, gosh, I want more friends, but you don't want to just walk up to another grown-up and say, will you be my friend? How do we get started?
Yeah, the first thing is we have to let go of the idea that friendship happens organically. Mm-hmm. As adults, it does not. As kids, we have these ingredients, continuous unplanned interaction and shared vulnerability. We see people every day. We let our guard down through gym, recess, right? And that's what fosters organic connection. As adults, we no longer are inhabiting settings like that, right? At work, we see people every day, but we usually are not particularly vulnerable with our colleagues. So that means that you can't rely on friendship happening organically. In fact, doing so is related to being more lonely over time. And you're going to have to initiate. Now, people are very afraid of initiating, but I like to share with people, the research actually finds people are less likely to reject you than you think. There's research on a phenomenon called the liking gap, wherein when strangers interact and are asked to predict, how much do you think the other person likes you? We tend to underestimate just how liked we are. The more self-critical we are, the more pronounced this underestimation. So I suggest assume people like you. Because according to other research on something called the acceptance prophecy, when people are told that they'll go into a group and be liked based on their personality profile, and even if this is a lie, it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy because it makes people warmer, friendlier, more engaged.
On a practical level, so we know somebody at work or a friend of a friend or whatever, what are some ways to build that relationship in a friendshiply direction?
Yeah. So, right. I talked about the problem at work being that we only show one dimension of us. A great way to bring out multiple dimensions of us is something called repotting, which was created by Ryan Hubbard at the Kite String Project. And that's the idea of varying the settings in which we interact, right? So stop interacting at work. Stop talking about work. Like, share who you are as a real person. Say to them, like, oh, it's been so nice to like get to know you at work. Like, would you want to go for a walk after work? Or, you know, I was going to go to the museum this weekend. Would you be up for that? Right. And that also makes the friendship more sustainable. People complain, well, when the work is over, we no longer see each other. But once you have precedent for seeing each other, even when you're not in the working hours, it's going to be easier to maintain it if there's transitions as well.
Now, you write about the psychology of our attachment styles. What is an attachment style and how does it affect our friendship journeys?
Yeah, great question. So attachment style is basically a template we have for how people will treat us that we create in childhood and update throughout life. And this template we have, this expectation for how other people will treat us, is ridden with confirmation bias, such that we see in the world things that match our expectation and discount experiences that don't match it. So there's three major attachment styles. Secure people, their template is people are trustworthy. They'll love me, they'll accept me. And that means they behave in ways that reflect this template. They are open, vulnerable, better at initiating friendships, less likely to end friendships, according to the research. They move away from people that aren't nice and aren't friendly. They're just very comfortable with themselves. They assume people like them, right? Versus anxiously attached people whose template is people are going to abandon you. So how do they navigate friendships because of that? They move very quickly, are sort of like overshare from the beginning, tend to have these very fragile friendships. They assume they're being rejected even when they're not. And then it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy because then they try to reject because they think they're rejected. And they sort of manifest their greatest fears because of that. And then you have avoidantly attached people who are also afraid of abandonment and fundamentally think others are untrustworthy. So how do they handle these fears? The avoidantly attached people, they keep to themselves. They're the lone wolves. They're never vulnerable. They're not really trying in their friendships. They end up ghosting more than other attachment styles. People feel like I'm around him, but I don't actually know him because he never actually shares anything about himself. They suppress their emotions. They're very uncomfortable with anyone else's emotions. So conflict is a big fear of them. They can be sort of people pleasing, so they don't have to face some emotions in others.
We're talking to psychologist Marissa G. Franco about her new book, Platonic, How the Science of Attachment Can Help You Make and Keep Friends. We want to hear what you think at 800-642-1234. Kind of surprised. I guess we don't have friends in Wisconsin. Do you have a story of friendship you want to share with us? Do you need some advice from our guest on maybe making a friendship or maintaining past friendships? Love to hear from you. If you have a question, a thought, an experience you would like to share about making or maybe losing friends along the way, call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're talking to Marissa G. Franco about her new book. It's called Platonic, How the Science of Attachment Can Help You Make and Keep Friends. You can join in with your story of friendship, maybe a tough time in your life where you've had trouble making friends, maybe after moving or moving to a new job, say. What's worked for you? What doesn't? What questions do you have? Call 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls now. Elizabeth is with us in Madison. Elizabeth, hi.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. I'm known for keeping in touch with my friends. They always talk about how great I am about doing that. I have friends from 30, 40, 45 years back that I've kept in touch with. And I think that friendship, it does take work or effort to be able to keep in touch with people and, you know, keep up with their addresses or emails or new phone numbers, but it's really worth it. And I just think that was the important point I wanted to make.
I love Elizabeth. I'll tell you, you're a better friend than I am and probably a better person too. Marissa, I'm the opposite of Elizabeth. I'm famously abysmal at keeping in touch with people. And I'm one of those people who gets, you know, I feel guilty and I'm like, oh, it's too late. I can't, you know, I feel like an idiot if I reach out. How do we be more like Elizabeth than like me?
Yeah. Well, first of all, it's lovely that you have positive intent. And Elizabeth, I'm glad that you are able to do all of those things because I'm sure you're making other people feel so, so loved. I think part of the ways we get better at it is we change our framework for friendship. I think a lot of us have this frame of friends. It's good vibes only. It's easy. It's not that. And so it's not on our list of priorities, right? Because of how we've just been socialized and conditioned to see it. But in fact, I think I argue that there's a difference between good company and a good friend. That good company is someone whose time you enjoy. They put you in a good mood, right? You like them as a person, but that is not a good friend. To be a good friend, it's a responsibility, an investment, a commitment in another person, right? It's, I'm going to be there to support you in your times of need. I'm going to try to make you feel safe when you're vulnerable. When you succeed, I'm going to celebrate you, right? I think our framework for friends needs to be more similar to our framework for romance, which is I need to put in time and effort, and there's times where this is going to be hard, but I also know that it's really worth it. And so it's really making friendship a priority amidst all of our other priorities.
Thanks again for that call, Elizabeth, at 800-642-1234. Paul joins us next in Northern Illinois. Paul, hi.
Hey, how's it going, Rob? I love your show. You know it.
Thanks.
I wanted to... I had to laugh when I was listening. I heard this, hi, my name is Paul. Will you be my friend? And actually, that's how my wife describes me. And I guess I'm trying to understand, is there a potential to have a combination of these friendships? In other words, I have friends that I consistently meet up with, and we go through the deeper deeps. And then I have wonderful companions, like a girl that I met in an airplane that took me all around you know, a Caribbean island because we just happened to talk on the plane
wow.
together with my wife. I'm just curious, like, are there gray lines? You know,
Paul, I think I gotcha. We can have a variety of friends, maybe Marissa, with a variety of roles in our lives.
Yeah. Yeah, this is a great question. And, you know, I think that's the beauty of friendship, that it can occur on such a spectrum, right? Like now some people are even choosing friends for their life partners, but we also have these sort of friendly acquaintances. I also talk about in the book this idea of low-dose friends, right? There's some people that we like some parts of them, we don't like others, and you might think, oh, this person can't be my friend, but in fact, you could really enjoy their company at low doses. If you see them once a month, you're like, oh, I'm happy, that was nice. But if you see them more frequently, it's like, oh, no. And so that's the beauty of friendship. We can sort of turn the dial down or turn the dial up based off of the connection we have, the degree of compatibility that we feel. And so it can just give us so much versatility.
Paul, thanks a lot for sharing that with us at 800-642-1234. Talking to Marissa G. Franco. Her new book is called Platonic: How the Science of Attachment Can Help You Make and Keep Friends. Back to your calls at 800-642-1234. Matt is with us in Wonder Lake, Illinois. Matt, hi.
Hi. Love WPR. Love the Ideas Network. I just wanted to comment really quick. You know, I was a millennial in Chicago, went to art school, had a number of bands, a couple of my bands toured the world, and we had incredible experiences together. However, like after the pandemic, we all seemed to go our separate ways, and it's been, really, really tough reestablishing some sort of connection with my former bandmates and the people that I was so close to making art with. And I just wanted to speak on that. And, you know, I really try to make an effort, and, you know, when those efforts aren't reciprocated, it can be kind of hurtful. So I just wanted to speak on that and just say, you know, continue to reach out to your good friends. And, hopefully one day you'll be able to hang out with them in the same capacity again. So thank you.
Matt, thanks a lot for that call. Marissa, I'm guessing Matt is very much not alone in that, you know, pandemic disruption of the life with friends. Do you have some advice for him and other people in that situation trying to rebuild?
Yeah, well, Matt, I really love your investment in your previous friendships. I think more generally, we saw in the pandemic a sort of split in how friendship was affected, right? For those people that your friendship is a companionate friendship, it's contingent on you doing activities together, it was a real blow. We couldn't do activities together. But for those people whose friendship was founded on sharing the deep, vulnerable, profound stuff, right? Reaching out when we're struggling and getting support, those friendships were a little bit more durable because we all needed support. So, hey, we were able to access them. It looks like this caller is sort of struggling because he's still invested in these friendships and his friends aren't. I think just some follow-up questions I have to ask is that, you know, we tend to devalue our friendships more if we don't see them in person. So have you tried to see these friends in person so they can sort of recognize your chemistry and your dynamic and how much they value you, right? That when we're apart from people, it's hard for us to viscerally feel that connection in the same way than when we're in person. I think it's also helpful to think about friendship as flexible, not fragile. What I mean by that is friendships ebb and flow, right? And if you're in an ebb and you assume it's fragile, then you're going to assume it's over and you're not going to reach out anymore. But it might be that this is going to flow again at another time when, you know, your friends are in a good place. So you can sort of treat it that way. That being said, I hear that it hurts when the relationships don't feel so reciprocal and you're the only one reaching out. And I also wanted to say, it'll be important to find relationships that are reciprocal, right? To find those people that are ready and available. And we tend to find those in transitioners. That's people who just moved to a city, who are going through a divorce or breakup, who just retired. They tend to be particularly open to friendship. So I think that's a good place to start.
Thanks for that call. Good luck. Hope that helps. Time for one more caller. Kimberly is with us in Arena. Kimberly, hi.
Hi. So I tend to be the extroverted friend. I'm the one that's always taking my crew of introverted friends along with me because I'm making all of the decisions or, hey, let's all go out here tonight. I've just been kind of experiencing a lot of decision fatigue from that lately. And so then I end up staying home because I don't want to go out and make decisions or make everybody go someplace. So then everybody else ends up staying home.
Oh, no.
And we just keep going through the same cycles because then I'll be tired. We won't do anything and then go right back to it. And we just can't seem to find a balance. I don't know.
Interesting. Kimberly, thanks for the call. Marissa, briefly, do you have advice for Kimberly to have some of those introverts get on board and organize it and make some of the decisions?
Yeah, Kimberly, I think maybe trying to automate your hangouts, like every other Wednesday we're going to go to this restaurant or every other Wednesday we're going to choose to go to someone's house can be a really great way to do it. The other thing I wonder is if you've made your expectations if you have asserted them in an upfront way, right? Or if you're just sort of upset about this and hoping someone will kind of get the hint. And I think just saying something as simple as like, hey, y'all, really want to see y'all. Coordinating, being the coordinator can sometimes be hard on me. Would we be open to sort of rotating who sets up our plans and see what they say?
Good luck, Kimberly. In just our last minute or so, Marissa, rescuing the word love. I think we just think of romantic love in our society now. Make the case for thinking of love as something we have for our friends.
So there's this Italian philosopher who says platonic love is a love so beautiful that it transcends the physical. And so I think we can see that each love is beautiful. Romantic love is beautiful, but platonic love is beautiful too. And it, in its non-sexual nature, right, it provides us with its own offerings in its fluidity. It provides us with its own offerings and its versatility, right? In the fact that our friends can be an entire community, whereas for most of us, our spouse is limited to one person. It provides us with unique offerings, which make it so that friendships cannot be replaced by any other type of relationship.
Marissa, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Marissa G. Franco, psychologist with the University of Maryland. She's with us today to talk about her new book. It's called Platonic, How the Science of Attachment Can Help You Make and Keep Friends. Hey, if you want to shout out one of your friends, we would love to hear from you. You can email ideas@WPR.org or head over and post on the Ideas Network Facebook page with a story of a friendship that's been important in your own life. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, some college athletes are making money now for the use of their names and images after some rules changes, and UW-Madison and other programs are figuring out how it all works. Find out what's going on and how it could affect college sports. And polio is showing up in parts of the United States among unvaccinated people after years of success against that disease because of widespread vaccine use. A health expert tells us about polio and how to make sure it stays under control. And more. It's coming up tomorrow here on Central Time on the Ideas Network. Coming up after the news, life expectancy in the U.S. is declining at the largest rate since World War II. A population health expert tells us how the pandemic and other factors led to that decline and some of the things we can do to turn it around. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, American consumers continue to pay more for costs like food and housing. But even as inflation continues to be a problem, an economist tells us the cure could cause even more problems. First, average life expectancy in the U.S. dropped in 2021 to 76.1 years. It continued a downward trend from 2020 that was the biggest decrease in U.S. life expectancy since World War II. COVID-19 has been a significant contributor to that decline, but the pandemic also added to some negative health trends that have been problems even before 2020. We're taking a closer look at some of the bigger public health trends that led to lower life expectancy and some possible solutions, and you could join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about life expectancy in the U.S. and why it's gone down the last couple of years? If you work in the healthcare industry, what kind of things are you seeing? Are you optimistic we'll turn things around as we get further removed from the peak of the pandemic? Are there lessons you think or hope we've learned from the pandemic that can make our health better in the future? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Michal Engelman is an associate professor of sociology at the UW-Madison and director of the Wisconsin Longitudinal Study. Michal, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks very much for having me.
Before we dig into the story behind these numbers, can you tell us what this life expectancy measure we're seeing in the headlines actually measures?
Sure. So life expectancy is basically the average number of years that people in the United States live. So it's a population level average. It tells us how long people live, and the way it's calculated when you hear things like life expectancy in 2021 or in 2020 is by taking into account, into a mathematical model, information about death rates at every age and sort of adding all of that up to figure out on average how long people live.
Now, a lot of the story of this decline in life expectancy has to do with COVID, but I want to start a little before that and set the stage. We see charts where when we compare the United States to, say, a lot of European countries, pre-COVID, we had lower life expectancy there, and we saw some disparities behind those numbers. Can you set the stage with us before the pandemic even hit?
Absolutely. You're absolutely right. What we saw here, even before the pandemic, was a situation where life expectancy in the United States had fallen behind that of peer countries, especially other high-income countries. In all places, including in the United States, what we were used to seeing over the course of the 20th century and even a little bit before was steady increases in life expectancy between innovations in healthcare, innovations in standard of living, better sanitation, better living conditions, better working conditions. We had gotten used to a situation where kind of every year we seemed to be doing better and better. We got better at improving the health of infants and the health of mothers and the health of teenagers and the health of middle-aged people and even pushing back chronic disease and mortality in later life. So things were improving. But over the last couple of decades, actually, even though we continue to see some improvements in the United States, the pace of those improvements was falling behind that of other countries. They were sort of getting better at a faster pace. And then over the last, I would say, you know, 5 or 6 years, we noticed that not only was the U.S. not improving as rapidly as other countries, but we seemed to be kind of holding steady or stagnating. We just weren't making progress at the same pace. And so there was already a lot of concern among people in the research community and in the policy community about why it is that the U.S. wasn't keeping up with other countries and what it was about potentially inequities within our own country and differences in health and longevity between different subgroups that might be contributing to that. And then the pandemic sort of came on the scene and really mapped on and exacerbated those
patterns. So 2020 hits, COVID-19 hits, and not only does life expectancy go down in the United States, as I mentioned, it looks, as if you look at the charts, the gap between the United States and European countries gets even bigger than it was pre-pandemic. Why?
Yeah, it's a really good question. So, you know, one has to do with sort of the extent to which the United States was prepared or unprepared for COVID and the way in which we responded to the pandemic relative to responses in other countries. So the way in which we kind of approached questions that had to do with mitigation strategies that included everything from kind of the early days of lockdowns to then later debates about masking and about vaccination. The U.S. approached all of that very differently in terms of its pandemic response. But part of it is also those pre-existing inequities sort of left large swaths of the U.S. population more vulnerable to the negative impact of the pandemic as well. And so it mapped on for that. We also see that whereas in many other peer countries, 2020 saw a big drop, and then we saw kind of an improvement in life expectancy in 2021. What we see in the U.S. is kind of a continued drop rather than an improvement.
We're talking to Michal Engelman, Associate Professor of Sociology at UW-Madison, Director of the Wisconsin Longitudinal Study. We're talking about this story. You may have seen the headlines, life expectancy going down in the United States in 2020, no surprise. But again, in 2021, a little more of a surprise. We're looking at what's led to that, how we can get out of it. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 with your reactions to the news, your thoughts on why this is happening, possible solutions, and of course, your questions. 800-642-1234 is the number. Michal, you mentioned a couple times the inequities in health in the United States, and I know that comes in many forms. Healthcare access, healthy communities. Can you talk about some of the biggest disparities you see in the United States?
Absolutely. So first of all, I would say, you know, the United States, when the pandemic hit, was already a country that was really struggling with racialized inequities, both in health and in wealth, right? So wealth in terms of access to resources that allow people to access healthcare, but also in terms of accessing resources that keep them healthy and not needing specialized healthcare. in the first place. And these inequities correspond with long-standing patterns of geographic segregation. So you see big differences in life expectancy, even within individual cities in the U.S. By zip codes, in different neighborhoods. There's also geographic differences between urban areas and rural areas. And of course, all of this is also related to the political polarization in our country. And so when the pandemic hit, you might remember it first kind of appeared in urban areas where people live and work and play sort of in close quarters. And so the pandemic first really disproportionately affected relatively younger members of Indigenous, Black, and Latino communities, especially those that were serving as frontline workers. I would say both in healthcare as well as in other kind of food preparation and service sectors. And then over the past year, you see that it's been affecting white populations more broadly and spreading throughout the countries, with kind of popping up in different hotspots around our state and around the country.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Jeremy is with us in Racine. Jeremy, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I know we like to use inequities for a lot of reasons why things get bad. But I think we're overlooking a major factor, and that's the obesity rate in the United States is far higher than any other Western country in the world. Can we discuss more about poor dieting and kind of get away from the inequity thing and focus on the real elephant in the room in regards to what the average American consumes on a daily basis based on caloric needs, the type of foods they're eating, the type of lifestyles we're living? Is a lot different than Europe and around the world. So,
Jeremy, I gotcha. Michal, what do we know about the impact of obesity, Jeremy wonders, and nutrition in the United States and its impact on some of these differences?
So, I mean, Jeremy is right that obesity rates in the United States are high, but it turns out that research that's trying to link obesity to specifically life expectancy and mortality shows us that it's not always so straightforward. So there's no doubt that obesity increases the risk of many chronic conditions, especially things like cardiovascular disease and diabetes, and things that also kind of are major causes of death beyond COVID over the last few years. But it's also the case that obesity in and of itself is an outcome of some of the social and economic inequities that we're talking about. There are big differences in the foods that people have access to, the time they have to engage in exercise, the places that they have access to in being active. And so, you know, while certainly it contributes to poor health, I think there are the links to mortality there's still a lot of research looking into that in particular, and also increasingly a recognition that we have to ask sort of why is it so different? Why are these rates so different in America relative to other places? And why are they so different even within America?
We're talking to sociology professor Michal Engelman about declining U.S. life expectancy over the last couple of years and what it could take to turn it around. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How do you think the U.S. pandemic response impacted our life expectancy, our long-term well-being? What would you like to have seen done differently? And even setting the pandemic aside, to the extent we can do that, what do you wonder about? What kind of health factors do you think are at play here? What questions do you have for our guest? Have you lived both in the United States and in a place like, say, Europe, where life expectancy tends to be longer, where the impact of the pandemic overall seems to have been less on life expectancy? Compare and contrast. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with Michal Engelman. She's an associate professor of sociology at UW-Madison and director of the Wisconsin Longitudinal Study. She's with us today looking at why life expectancy has declined over the last couple of years in the United States. Longer-term trends even before the pandemic, too, had raised some warning flags, and looking at what we could do to maybe turn things around. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 with your reactions to that news, your thoughts, your questions for our guest. And do you think we need changes to how we provide healthcare in the United States, for example, how we react to the outbreak of new diseases? If you work in healthcare, love to hear what you've seen over the last couple of years. You could join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Michal, let's start to look at some possible solutions. Do you see low-hanging fruit out there where we could make a big difference, hopefully, without huge investments that would take maybe years to develop?
That's a good question, right? I mean, certainly, I think, you know, one of the key things is when you see a decline this big, you know that things can be better because we've been there before, right? And so at the very least, we can try to make up some of the recent losses and then kind of continue to think more about how we get beyond there and how we catch up to where other countries have been. And so I think, you know, it is reassuring to see that the declines, while still going on, are becoming less, right? And I think we can attribute that to higher rates of vaccinations and to also higher rates of people who have been sick and have developed, some immunity, some resistance to a virus that unfortunately seems like it will be with us for a long time. I think, you know, we have learned a lot about things that we can do as individuals to protect ourselves from COVID. We've also learned that there are many things that can happen on a broader scale, right? Like improving ventilation in buildings like schools and office buildings and places where people spend a lot of time together. So all of these sort of accumulated knowledge, I think, will help keep us safe from the pandemic specifically. And then I think we've also learned that in many ways, you know, in the US, we are most comfortable thinking about what it is that we as individuals can do ourselves in order to keep ourselves well and healthy. But if there is one lesson that we learn from a pandemic that is global in this way, is that we really all are in some ways all in this together, whether we want to or not. And the best way the best sort of tools or the best things that we can do in order to do better in terms of life expectancy is to work collectively on improving the health of the public.
How about our public health system, or I guess systems, because we have federal agencies and state and county and local. And I think an accusation made, and probably pretty fair, was that they didn't necessarily coordinate that well at every level when the pandemic started. Can we do better?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, you're right that coordination across the multiple levels is key. I think one thing that has been really striking, or that I've noticed in observing, is that, you know, people do still seem to have good levels of trust in their local public health authorities, right? There is a sense that there are people here on the ground in your town, right, in your state, who really kind of understand the situation. There is less trust that I've seen sort of and at higher level things, right? As you said, there have been criticisms of the way in which the pandemic has been handled on the federal government level in terms of the CDC. So there, I think, you know, in addition to coordination, communication is really clear, right? Pandemics are confusing. There's a lot happening as they move through the population. Our knowledge changes and the science changes. And what has been really, really tricky here is, I think, figuring out how to clearly communicate to people both what's happening in real time, but also how to understand the fact that the facts might be changing. And that means, you know, changing kind of our behavior and response as well. And so I agree that, you know, there is room for improvement on the communication front and in helping people understand what is it that's guiding the recommendations that are coming down from public health authorities, right? We focus a lot on understanding and translating the science. I think it's also important to be really clear in communicating what our values are and what it is that we're trying to do, right? How do we improve health for large swaths of people, even when we are sometimes asking individuals, right, to make sacrifices that they're not especially excited to make?
Talking to Michal Engelman, Associate Professor of Sociology at UW-Madison, looking at the news you may have seen, declining life expectancy in the U.S. over the last couple of years, looking at the reasons behind it, possible solutions. Still time for you to join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. Let's bring on another caller now. Steve is with us in Chippewa Falls. Steve, hi.
I didn't catch the whole show, but it strikes me that drug addiction deaths, like when an 18-year-old dies of a drug overdose, as far as life expectancy goes, that's going to be about as impactful as 15 or 16 older people dying from COVID. So wouldn't the low-hanging fruit be addressing drug addiction and the availability of fentanyl? Isn't that really what we should be focusing on rather than fighting the last war?
Steve, thanks a lot for the call. Michal, Steve brings up, I was going to actually hoping to get into both overdose deaths and other things that public health people call disease of despair, overdoses, yeah. Long-term effective addiction, suicide. Do we need more focus on those things, as Steve says?
Yeah, so absolutely. I mean, even in the most recent statistics that came out, we saw that in this past year, the decline that we're talking about between 2020 and 21, 50% of that is due to COVID, but the rest is due to an increase in deaths for a number of reasons. And sort of top among those other reasons is sort of things that are considered unintentional injuries, of which drug overdoses account for nearly half. Of that. And so, you know, you're right. It's an enormous problem. I think, you know, more than something close over 100,000 overdose deaths in a 1 year period, you know, in the most recent 1 year period. So it is definitely a huge issue. And I think, you know, the mortality from drug overdoses goes along with mortality from suicide, from other diseases that have to do with alcohol abuse, as well as drug abuse, right? And so there are certainly kind of a conglomeration of causes of death that seem to be related to a deep kind of malaise. Researchers have called it deaths of despair, and talked about the way in which, you know, it may be a way in which people's kind of dissatisfaction with life, with their standing, right, with the way things are going, are really manifesting in their health. And absolutely, that is a major issue. I think, you know, one of the challenges for public health authorities is not so much ranking and choosing between different causes of death, but really kind of figuring out how do we marshal the resources to address all of them, because they each require different kinds of solutions, even as sometimes many of them affect many of the same populations.
Thanks for that call, Steve. Michal, are you hoping that, you know, when we see a number like this, the annual report showing this decline in life expectancy, that gets a sense of urgency in people who make decisions that affect how we react to problems, whether they're an infectious disease or whether they're overdoses?
You know, as somebody who studies these statistics, I certainly hope so, right? I mean, it's pretty stark evidence that something's not going right, and that these mortality statistics, we call them summary measures of population health, right? Within a single number, you can really convey a lot of information that things don't seem to be going right. And so, yeah, the hope is definitely that in publishing these reports, this gives us impetus for moving in the right direction. But I have to say, you know, I would love to think that evidence and data and research are the main thing that drive policy decisions and decisions about how to allocate resources. But I think we all know that there are a lot of politics and that come into play here as well. So I'm very, very hopeful that these numbers can serve as a wake up call and help us really figure out, you know, how to focus, how to make things better, and how to address both the mortality and the underlying conditions that are causing it. So
we'll leave it there. Michal, thanks again for joining us today.
It was great to be here. Thank you.
That's Michal Engelman, Associate Professor of Sociology at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and the director there of the Wisconsin Longitudinal Study. She was with us today for a look at a decline in life expectancy in the United States over the last couple of years. Yes, partly because of COVID, but that's not the whole story, and for a look at possible solutions over the next few years. Coming up after the news, an economist says in the long run, maybe even the medium run, it's deflation we should be worried about. Deflation instead of inflation. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.